Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
The Global Story with smart takes and fresh perspectives on one big news story. Every Monday to Friday from the BBC World Service. Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts. To find out more,
this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Rachel Wright, and at 14 hours GMT on Thursday, the 14th of December, these are our main stories. An EU summit is divided over Ukraine between 26 member states and Viktor Orban, the Hungarian Prime Minister. A senior US official arrives in Israel amid mounting criticism of the bombing of Gaza. President Putin resumes his annual press conference and talks at length about Ukraine and the West. Also in this podcast, Afghan families cross 11 countries to get to the US.
When we were crossing, we saw many dead bodies. That was the most tragic part of the travel.
And the men who shot the US national symbol. We begin in Brussels, where the stage is set for a showdown at the EU summit. With 26 member states in favour of aid to Ukraine and talks to start accession proceedings, and one against, the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban. He has retained his stance despite what one MEP described as the biggest bribe in EU history from the European Commission to Hungary last night. Viktor Orban showed his scepticism on the way into the summit.
The government's stance at present is that Ukraine's fast admission to the European Union would have unpredictable consequences. Ukraine's fast lane accession does not serve the interests of either Hungary or the European Union.
Also speaking on arrival, Lithuania's president Gitanas Nausėda issued a stark warning to the Hungarians.
If we will spoil or if we will abuse the unanimity principle, there will be more and more voices asking why we still take the decisions on the consensus basis.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said that Putin would try to exploit the summit's failure, arguing that now is not the time for half measures or hesitation. I spoke to our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhard, who's in Brussels.
That last clip there by President Nausėda really got to the heart of it. Whether Hungary uses a veto, these decisions have to be made on the principle of unanimity. And there's a lot of frustration amongst other leaders that Prime Minister Orban is taking the stance he is on Ukraine. So basically, the foreign policy chief of the European Union, Josep Borrell, said that this is an existential issue for Europe. It's not just about Ukraine security, but wider European security as well. And the Estonian Prime Minister, Kaja Kallas, she said she wasn't optimistic. She hopes for some agreement on some points. Because at the moment, Rachel, Mr. Orban is saying he isn't going to change stance. And we wait to see whether that shifts in the day. He's coming under a lot of pressure. He's been meeting President Macron of France, Chancellor Scholz of Germany, and the head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, before the talks even begin.
And remind me what has been described as the biggest bribe in EU history. Remind me what that was.
Well, that was a decision yesterday by the European Commission to free up $11 billion of frozen funds. These were funds that were frozen in a long-running dispute between the Commission and Hungary on issues such as the rule of law. Now, the Commission says that the timing of this, which does look very suspicious, isn't anything to do with the actual decision itself, that Hungary had passed a series of legislation reforms to change some of the issues that the Commission had with the rule of law in terms of protecting judicial independence, and that the funds are being freed up because of that. But obviously not a lot of people are swallowing that on some quarters. That your quote about the biggest bribe in EU history was from a German Green MEP, and he is not the only one. The money doesn't come out in one big block. Hungary would still need to apply for it in pieces, and there are still conditions attached. Whether it shifts Prime Minister Orban's thinking on Ukraine or not, he's shown no indication of that up to this point.
our regional editor, Danny Aberhod. To Moscow now, where President Putin has been speaking at his end-of-year news conference, his first since Russia invaded Ukraine because last year's event was cancelled. In a lengthy interview, the Russian leader insisted the army would continue with its war in Ukraine and that there wouldn't be peace until Moscow has achieved its goals. He painted a positive picture of Russian advances on the battlefield. Responding to a question, Mr. Putin also addressed the question of peace in Ukraine.
There will be peace when we achieve our goals, which you've just spoken about. Now, let's return to those goals. They do not change. I'll remind you what we spoke about back then, about the denazification of Ukraine, about its demilitarization, about its neutral status.
All main Russian TV channels are carrying the press conference. It usually lasts around 4 hours. Our Russian analyst, Vitaly Shevchenko, has been following the story and gave me a flavour of what Mr. Putin has been saying.
It's noteworthy, I think, that he has been heavily focused on Ukraine. And what he actually said was not that unusual. He defended his so-called special military operation against Ukraine. He painted a very rosy picture of how things were going for his troops in Ukraine. He said the situation for them was improving, while for the Ukrainians it was a tragedy. He sounded as defiant as ever. He said Russian objectives in Ukraine, they remained in place. Demilitarizing, denazifying Ukraine, quote unquote, and making sure Ukraine never joined NATO. And upsettingly for Ukrainians, yet again, he questioned Ukraine's very national identity by saying that Ukrainians and Russians are one and the same people. And he questioned Ukraine's territorial integrity as well by saying that huge swathes of southeastern Ukraine actually belonged to Russia. So from that point of view, nothing new there.
Of course, the news conference didn't happen last year. Is the fact that it's happened this year a sign of real confidence?
I think there are two main reasons for it. One, as you say, is, of course, last year it was becoming clear that his special military operation against Ukraine wasn't really going to plan. And also, secondly, if he were not be holding it now, that would have raised so many questions, because these Q&As, they're such a firm part of the Putin narrative, if you like. This is what he normally does annually. And to give it a miss 2 years in the row, that would have been a big deal.
Of course, an election is coming next year. Are we getting a sense of what he's campaigning on?
It's probably what the same platform that he offered to Russians for more than 20 years of being in charge of Russia, which is so firmly based on this idea that Russia is locked in a centuries-long fight against the evil, scheming West, and it has to defend itself in Ukraine. And this focus on foreign policy in his platform is also reflected in today's Q&A, because most of it has been about foreign policy.
Vitaly Shevchenko. When the Taliban captured Kabul more than 2 years ago, tens of thousands of Afghans were evacuated by the US for their own safety. But many were left behind and are taking a much riskier journey to the United States. The BBC's Regan Morris travelled to Tijuana on the US-Mexico border, where Afghans have been arriving in record numbers since 2021.
Shukriya cries as she shows me footage of her journey across 11 countries to get from Afghanistan to Mexico.
Your leg is gashed from the jungle.
The photos show cuts they got from walking through rough terrain. Some show the young family sleeping on the streets. Torrential rain in Panama as they climb a mountain. And then she shows me a close-up of her daughter's face.
So they punched your 9-year-old daughter to get money.
Her eye bruised black and blue. Shukriya says armed gunmen made the men and women strip naked to search for money. Then they beat the children.
The fight was over money. They surrounded us and took what they wanted.
She says they're all traumatized. Many migrants hire smugglers to cross the Darien Gap in Panama. But Shukriya and other Afghans relied on directions they found on social media. And they just followed the crowd. Thousands of people now pass daily through the jungle, which was once considered impassable.
When we were crossing, we saw many dead bodies. That was the most tragic part of the travel.
Sophia was a student at the American University in Kabul, which made her eligible for a U.S. evacuation flight in 2021. But in all the chaos, she couldn't get through the crowds which mobbed the airport.
We were left behind, and then the U.S. embassy told us that you can go to Pakistan and fill a form, and we will process your case. But we stayed more than a year in Pakistan. But still, our case was not getting processed.
The Latina Muslim Foundation opened this shelter in 2022 to give the growing number of Muslim migrants in Tijuana a place where they could pray and eat halal food and sleep safely in separate men's and women's dormitories.
Outside the shelter, you can see the border wall. We are like a stone's throw away. And these Afghans and others we spoke to inside, they can't really do much but stay within the confines of that shelter because they don't feel safe outside. They're afraid they'll get arrested. So they stay inside waiting and waiting for an asylum appointment.
They try every day to use the U.S. government's new CBP One app to get an appointment to claim asylum. The app was meant to simplify the process, but it hasn't. Some people get an appointment right away. Others say it just glitches and crashes all the time. Some wait weeks or months.
And that's why when they don't have any other options, they have to cross illegally to the U.S.
How long have you been here?
I have been here more than 2 months.
Even if they do make it to the United States, their future is uncertain. The Afghan Adjustment Act, the legislation proposed by the Biden administration to grant permanent residency for many Afghan refugees, is stalled in the U.S. Congress. And with lawmakers debating ways to make claiming asylum much more difficult, their journey is far from over.
Regan Morris. And if you want to hear more about this story, go to today's The Global Story podcast, Why Are Afghan Refugees Stuck on the U.S.-Mexico Border, wherever you get your podcasts. Could today be the beginning of a new phase in the war in Gaza? The US President Joe Biden has indicated that Israel is losing global support for its war against Hamas and is sending his national security adviser Jake Sullivan to Israel today for talks. But those talks will be tricky. On Wednesday, Israel's foreign minister declared the war against Hamas would continue with or without international support. Sharon Haskell is a member of the Israeli Parliament for the Conservative National Unity Party. She told the BBC it was essential for Israel to stick to its aim of eradicating Hamas.
Their leadership have said time and time again that they will always persecute the Jews and try to murder them if they have any kind of opportunity. They will try to do the massacre that they did on the 7th of October over and over again. And so this war is an actual war on humanity. I mean, this is the only way that we can defend our children.
Our Jerusalem correspondent, Yolan Nell, told us more about the visit.
He's said to be coming here to urge the Israelis to be more surgical and precise with their strikes against Hamas targets in Gaza. First of all, of course, we've had the criticism from Joe Biden this week when the president has said that Israel's indiscriminate bombardment in Gaza is leading to a loss of global support. We're also seeing in the Israeli media that there's a possible talk of another pause in fighting to allow hostages to be released, Mr. Sullivan will also be talking about ways to speed up the flow of aid and the distribution of aid into Gaza. And we're hearing also that he'll discuss with the war cabinet in Israel a timetable to end the war, a vision for Gaza after the war. And these are areas where there are serious disagreements between Israel and the US, its closest ally, an ally which gives billions of dollars in military support, and also acts, of course, as a diplomatic shield for Israel, especially at the UN, where this week we've seen overwhelming support at the General Assembly for a ceasefire.
So possibly a new phase of the war?
I mean, it's difficult to say exactly at this stage, but I think time is running out for this very intense stage of the war where we're seeing Israeli ground forces deep inside Gaza and continuing bombardment of the Gaza Strip, with the media in Gaza, Hamas-controlled media, talking about how 24 people were killed in an Israeli strike that hit two houses in Rafah, in the very south of the territory, for example. We don't have immediate confirmation of the numbers of people killed in the latest strikes. Certainly, there has been a lot of speculation in the Israeli media in recent days that this stage of the war could be ended more quickly due to international pressure than perhaps Israeli military commanders would like. Ideally, we're told that they would like to continue through into January with this intensity of the war before pulling back some of their soldiers, where they have at the moment they have, you know, several army divisions deep inside the Gaza Strip. They would pull them out towards the edge of the Gaza Strip to the buffer zone. I mean, what's really a great problem for Israel at the moment? It really wants to show that it has delivered a victory over Hamas. And still, there are very senior leaders, the likes of Yahya Sinwar, the Hamas leader in Gaza. His whereabouts exactly unknown. He's thought he could be in Khan Yunis, which has been so much a focus of the southern offensive. But, you know, Israel has not at this stage got any evidence that it has managed to capture or kill those very senior people that it holds as being the masterminds of the 7th of October attacks, in which, of course, more than 1,200 people were killed in southern Israel, those cross-border attacks by thousands of Hamas fighters that led to Israel's deadliest day in its 75-year history.
Yoland Nell in Jerusalem. 950 billion tonnes. That's what scientists monitoring the world's biggest iceberg say it weighs. They worked it out using satellite measurements. And as our science correspondent Jonathan Amos reports, it used to be even bigger.
Imagine a field of ice more than twice the area of Greater London, but as thick as its skyscrapers are tall. This is A23A, current title holder of the world's biggest iceberg. Scientists have used radar pulses from a European Space Agency satellite to essentially take a tape measure to the Colossus. The researchers from the UK's Centre for Polar Observation and Modelling say the berg has lost quite a bit of mass since breaking away from the Antarctic coast in 1986, but it still tips the scales at 950 billion tonnes. As A23A moves north and warms in the coming weeks, its melt rate will accelerate, and it'll be dumping more fresh water into the ocean daily than is consumed by the entire UK population.
Jonathan Amos. Coming up on the Global News podcast, a stark increase in road deaths in Africa.
I'm standing on Jinja Road, the intersection of the gateway into the city centre, one of the areas which the city authorities have listed as one of the black spots.
We ask why.
County Mayo's Gaelic football team haven't won an All-Ireland Championship since 1951.
Mayo got to the final so many times.
We get this far every year and we just can't get over the last step.
And tales of a priest's curse abound.
There's a long queue of excuses.
I put it down to the curse, been the only explanation.
Amazing Sports Stories investigates the curse of County Mayo.
I seen it firsthand.
Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back. The US House of Representatives has voted to formalise its impeachment inquiry into President Joe Biden, as you may have heard in our last podcast. But the case really concerns the president's son, Hunter Biden, who is accused of bribery and corruption. It's the story that President Biden just can't shake off. He's dismissed the inquiry as a stunt and said time would be better spent in Congress addressing military funding for Ukraine and Israel. David Willis in Washington gave us this update.
Well, House Republicans launched an informal investigation into President Biden's business dealings about 3 months ago without a vote on the matter. And so this vote formalises that inquiry, as expected. It went very much along party lines, Republicans voting in favour, Democrats voting against. And it gives House Republicans greater powers to depose witnesses, to enforce subpoenas, gather evidence and so on, including such evidence as bank records, text messages and email correspondence, mobile phone records and that sort of thing. Republicans have accused the president of benefiting financially from his son Hunter foreign business dealings during Biden Sr.'s time as vice president. That was during the Obama administration, of course. And that is something that both Joe and Hunter Biden emphatically deny. Republicans have been looking into Hunter Biden's business dealings in China and Ukraine, amongst other places, but they've yet to uncover any evidence of bribery or corruption. There is no chance of Joe Biden being removed from office because of this inquiry, because as well as an impeachment conviction in the House, the US Constitution requires a two-thirds vote of the Senate, of course, to convict a president and remove him from office. And Democrats hold the majority in the Senate. So that's not going to happen. But what this does do is it may well cause some Americans to question the morality of Joe Biden going into an election year which could see him, of course, going toe-to-toe with Donald Trump, who is himself facing a whole raft of criminal charges.
David Willis in Washington. To Africa now, which has witnessed a stark increase in traffic-related deaths over the past decade, up 17% despite a global decline over the same period, according to the World Health Organization. The fact is that more people now own cars in Africa, but the roads aren't that good. So road traffic accidents are now the ninth leading cause of death on the continent. Joe Walker is a Ugandan award-winning road safety advocate looking to save lives through his road safety awareness campaigns. Here's a clip he sent the BBC from Kampala.
I'm standing right here on Jinja Road, the intersection of the gateway into the city centre. One of the areas which the city authorities have listed as one of the black spots. What do I mean by the black spots? Where we've lost many people to road traffic crashes. In Uganda, every day on average, we lose 12 to 14 people to road crashes. And the majority of these, more than 80% of the victims, are cyclists and pedestrians. The cyclists, the majority of them, are definitely border riders. Border borders, we have more than 20,000 border borders in Uganda.
And just to mention, boda bodas are motorbike taxis, which are a common sight and used by many people across East Africa. Dr. Naan Tran is the leader of the World Health Organization's Safety and Mobility Unit.
The African continent actually was the only continent where there was an increase overall in the number of road traffic deaths over the last 10 years. And the number of these increases have been quite important. What I do want to highlight is that there actually were countries in the region that managed to reduce their number of fatalities. And so when we talk about the 17%, we're talking about an overall average for the continent. But I do want to mention that there were countries, for example, Congo, Burundi, and Rwanda, that were able to actually improve the road safety conditions over the last couple of the last 10 years.
And how do they do that?
Many of these countries have adopted what we have called the safe systems approach. And that means focusing on the entire transport system, thinking about the infrastructure, thinking about the safety of vehicles, as well as thinking about options for mobility for pedestrians and cyclists, making sure that they have safe passage. As you well know, in many of the cities, we see that there is only roads for cars. And as such, pedestrians and cyclists have to share essentially that space with cars. And that's really why you see the high number of deaths among pedestrians and cyclists that was just cited by the colleague in Uganda.
And picking up on that one, I wonder then, what is the WHO doing to help those countries, whether it's in Africa or around the globe, get to that safety?
Well, WHO is working with the governments very closely, and we're trying to do this with all of the governments in the region as well. But we're really trying to raise awareness of the magnitude of the problem. One of the biggest issues is that governments are not fully aware of the magnitude and how much of an impact this has on public health, but also on the economy. And we're also working with other global partners, such as institutions that finance infrastructure, to ensure that there are safeguards for safety when roads are being built. And we're also trying to work with other legislative bodies to ensure that vehicles that are entering into Africa actually have the same level of safety that there are in vehicles in other parts of the world. And currently, that's not the case. Many vehicles that are being sold in Africa don't have the same level of safety that we find in Europe or North America or even in parts of Asia. And that's a big problem.
Dr. Naan Tran of the WHO's Safety and Mobility Unit speaking to Victoria Owen-Kunda. Two men in the United States have been charged with illegally poaching and selling parts of more than 3,000 birds. The killings include the poaching of the national bird, the bald eagle. David Lewis has been following the story and gave me the details.
Simon Paul and Travis John Branson are alleged to have shot the birds over several years, and there were a lot of them, about 3,600 allegedly illegally killed by the men. Species included smaller birds as well as larger bald and golden eagles. An indictment released this week said the animals were killed on the Flathead Indian Reservation in western Montana and elsewhere. Court records state the pair then sold the wings, tails and other body parts, as well as whole dead eagles, for what they described as significant sums of cash. The bald eagle is a national bird of the United States and a part of the national psyche. It's depicted, of course, on the currency as well as the presidential seal that you'll see on the lectern when Joe Biden is making a formal address at the White House.
And what more do we know about these two men?
Well, Mr. Branson, who's 48, lives in Washington State, and the 42-year-old Mr. Paul is from Montana, close to the Flathead Reservation. Federal prosecutors say Mr. Branson would travel interstate to assist his co-defendant, according to the indictment posted online by the Daily Montana newspaper. It says from January 2019 until March 2021, Mr. Paul was, quote, the shooter and shipper of the birds. He would, quote, help kill, transport and ship bald and golden eagles for future sales on the black market. They say the pair killed deer and left them out to lure in eagles to feed. And Mr. Branson, for his part, sent messages showing off about, quote, going on a killing spree, the legal paper went on. On one date, Mr. Branson is said to have texted a photo to a purchaser showing a golden eagle tail set. The buyer replied, got that thang from Simon and the mirror feathers, TNKS, meaning thanks. The men who've been unavailable for comment will appear in court in January.
David Lewis. Scientists say they have discovered why some women become extremely sick during pregnancy. The condition, known as hyperemesis gravidarum, can threaten the life of mothers and babies. It affects hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of people every year. The scientists say the next stage of their research is to look at possible treatments. More details from our health reporter, Laura Foster.
This research by the universities of Cambridge, Glasgow and Edinburgh, as well as some from the USA and Sri Lanka, found out that the fetus produces a hormone called GDF15 as it grows. This goes into the mother's bloodstream and up to their brain, causing them to feel nauseous and ill. How sick they feel depends on how much the hormone is being produced by the baby-to-be, and how much GDF15 was in the mother's bloodstream before they became pregnant. The researchers say their next step is to start working on potential cures and treatments.
Laura Foster. And today, coming to a screen near you.
Perhaps now is the time.
This is what we expect to be the longest-serving monarch in history. People will want to celebrate your reign and mark the end of an era.
But what about the life I put aside? The woman I put aside? When I became queen.
The final episodes of the Netflix series The Crown, a television drama loosely based on the lives of the British royal family, is released today. The final instalments feature the years following the death of Diana, Princess of Wales. There have been mixed reviews by the critics who've seen it. Our arts correspondent, Vincent Dowd, has spent the morning watching the new episodes.
The Crown has had 60 episodes in 6 years. The creation, of course, of the writer Peter Morgan, who'd already written the film, a big hit, The Queen, in 2006, so he spent a long time writing about royals. When it started, some people disliked his idea of putting the life of the Queen, then, of course, still alive, into what was called by them an upmarket soap opera. But audiences around the world took to The Crown quickly, and the amount of press coverage and social media comment over the years has been beyond calculation. Released today are the six concluding episodes of the sixth and final season. The first four, as we've said, came out in November.
And these final episodes, I think, tell the story of the after the death of Princess Diana. Where does the series actually end?
Yes, I think Netflix were very keen to separate the main, let's call them Princess Diana elements, from the rest of the story. Inevitably, that was at times a grim watch. It couldn't have been anything else. In this final run, we pick up the story well after that point to remind people the Queen is still played by Imelda Staunton. Prince Philip is played by Jonathan Pryce. The critical consensus, I think it's fair to say, was often that in the middle stretch, the Crown did flag a bit. What we have in these final stories is the arrival of Tony Blair in Downing Street. The Queen calls him President Blair. The death of Princess Margaret in 2002, the romance between William and Kate, and obvious and building tensions between William and his brother Harry. The story ends before Meghan Markle appears, basically with the Queen's Golden Jubilee in 2002. But in this final episode, which I and lots of other people have been watching today, Peter Morgan does allow himself a certain amount of fantasy. There's a very powerful scene, I thought, involving a bagpipe lament. I won't explain any more than that. And it turns out we hadn't quite seen the end of Claire Foy and Olivia Colman, who of course played the Queen in Younger Life. I think it's a very strong ending.
And briefly, has the Crown shaped the way people around the world see the royal family?
Well, I think the positive is that it's shown the Queen, who of course came to the throne aged 25 only, to have been for decades a figure of great strength and dedication. But there are lots of people who weren't around when Diana died, and they may see events dramatised here as showing a monarch who was at times old-fashioned and unsympathetic. But it's complex. There were viewers who watched the middle episodes with their clear suggestion that Queen couldn't stand Margaret Thatcher as an argument for monarchy. So people will be discussing the Crown for a long time to come, I'm sure.
Vincent Dowd and I, for one, will be glued to my TV tonight. Well, that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Lewis Alsop, and the producer was Tracy Gordon. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Rachel Wright. Until next time, goodbye. Thank you.